Tonight, director Brett Ratner, editor and writer Bobby Osteen, cinematography great William A. Fraker, and critic Keith Ulick join the movie geeks as we examine one of the cinema's most brilliant and controversial figures, Mr. Roman Polanski. Coming up next on Movie Geeks United.
He is the most positive, the most outgoing human being I've ever met. He doesn't carry his tragedy on his shoulder.
This sort of unsettling feeling that you get from his film that was so exciting, it makes your skin crawl, makes you lean forward.
We knew he was an important director, and
he was young.
He was extremely young. I loved him, and I loved him for the fact that he knew how to tell a story visually.
What's kind of nice about Polanski is that Polanski is uniquely himself, can't be imitated, because his neuroses are so specific to him.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United. Big thrill to bring you the show tonight. My name is Jamie.
My name is Jerry, and we're very excited to have you all here tonight.
It's going to be a packed show. Our director series is built, designed to review, obviously, the works of an acclaimed filmmaker and kind of examine and delve into what makes these films so great and what makes these talents so singular. And tonight we're doing Roman Polanski. In the past we've done De Palma and Sidney Lumet and Alan Pakula and Brian, I already said De Palma.
Paul Schrader.
Movies and filmmakers that have really influenced us as film fans and in the cinematic realm in general.
Yeah.
Tonight we're doing Roman Polanski. We've been planning this for the past month.
At least the last month. I mean, more than that, I think, actually, but...
Yeah.
Current events,
Because he's such a interesting, fascinating man, and, mm-hmm. and his films have stood the test of time. I know people always bring up Rosemary's Baby and Chinatown, and for great reason. Those are two of the classics of the medium.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a wealth of additional titles that are equally as powerful and unique
mm-hmm.
and worthy of examination. And that's what we're going to do tonight. Now, we examine the man's works, but we also examine the artist himself and how influences in his life might influence his work. So as much as we can, I think Polanski is 76 years old, right?
Yes.
Something to that effect. As much as we can, we're going to, this is a jaw-dropping life he's had, we're going to give you an overview of the man's life and career in these next 12 minutes.
I know, and as impossible as that sounds, we're going to do it.
Yes. So here's a little primer on Mr. Polanski.
Roman Polanski was born in Paris in 1933. 3 years later, his parents moved the family to Krakow, Poland. After the war began in 1939, young Roman went into hiding, living with Polish peasants. His parents were both taken to separate concentration camps. When Roman was 12, he learned that his father had survived the ordeal of the camps, but his mother had not.
Right after the war, I didn't know what happened to my parents. And then when I was staying with Uncle, a little note came. People were returning from concentration camps, from labor camps, etc. It was a note from my father, so I knew he was alive. But he returned, and then I was told that my mother will not come back, that she was dead.
At a young age, Polanski lived in his imagination, and his earliest artistic pursuits engaged his passion for acting, as he worked on the stage, on radio, and in several Polish feature films. He began directing short films of his own when he attended film school in Poland. After graduating in 1959, Roman set out to direct his first feature-length film, the claustrophobic thriller Knife in the Water, a project that earned Polanski the Critics' Prize at the Venice International Film Festival and an Academy Award nomination for Best Foreign Film.
The film was very badly received in Poland. Critics and the authorities alike said that this is a product of rotten Western propaganda. And that somehow contributed to my leaving Poland right away and not coming back until many, many years later.
Polanski left Poland and made his first English-language film in England, the surrealistic horror film Repulsion. The film garnered Polanski more international acclaim, and coupled with Knife in the Water, attracted the attention of legendary producer Robert Evans, who viewed Polanski as the ideal visionary to helm his next prized project, Rosemary's Baby.
Get away from here! Roman!
You're rocking him too fast.
Sit down! Get her out of here! Put her where she belongs!
You're rocking him too fast. That's why he's crying.
Oh, mind your own business.
Let Rosemary rock him. Go on, sit down with the others. Let Rosemary rock him.
Well, she's like...
Sit down with the others, Laura Louise.
In the 2 years following Repulsion, Roman had made two additional well-received films in England, the tragic comedy Cul-de-Sac and the vampire parody The Fearless Vampire Killers, which is where he met his future wife, Sharon Tate. But it was Rosemary's Baby that would alter the face of his film career and catapult him into the ranks of superstar directors. And then, tragedy.
We have a weird homicide.
In a scene described by one investigator as reminiscent of a weird religious rite, five persons, including actress Sharon Tate, were found dead at the home of Miss Tate and her husband, screen director Roman Polanski. Miss Tate, who starred in Valley of the Dolls, was 8 months pregnant.
Despondent and distraught over the loss of his wife and unborn child, Polanski's first feature film following the murders was one of the darkest of his career, Shakespeare's Macbeth. In 1973, producer Robert Evans would summon Polanski once again, and what resulted was the film many consider to be his masterpiece and one of the most accomplished films in the history of the medium, Chinatown.
It required me to return to Los Angeles, and I was not very keen. It was only a few years after that tragedy where Manson's family killed Sharon Tate and several of my friends. And my first reaction was not to do this. And then I read the script, and it had great character of Gillis, the detective, and dealt with a subject which was very appealing, particularly to Americans, particularly to Californians.
Roman Polanski's Chinatown, wrote Roger Ebert, is not only a great entertainment, but something more, something I would have thought almost impossible. It's a 1940s private eye movie that doesn't depend on nostalgia or camp for its effect, but works because of the enduring strength of the genre itself. The film won a well-deserved Oscar for Robert Towne's brilliant screenplay and nominations across the board, including one for Polanski's masterful direction. Delivering another worldwide critical and commercial smash, Polanski had once again proven himself as one of our most unique and gifted artists.
Thank you.
In Chinatown, he exposed the dark side of corruption. In Repulsion, he explored a warped mind. In Rosemary's Baby, he examined the occult. Now, The Tenant, something altogether new, altogether chilling. No one does it to you like Roman Polanski.
Released in 1976, The Tenant featured Polanski as director and lead actor in what many describe as the third film in his apartment trilogy, following Repulsion and Rosemary's Baby. Following The Tenant, Polanski's life would once again fall into a tailspin, propelled by a series of events that continue to resonate to this day. In 1977, Polanski pled guilty to unlawful sexual intercourse with a minor, as reported in Marina Zinovich's 2008 documentary titled Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired. Polanski served 42 days in state prison as the result of a plea bargain. When the judge indicated he would dismiss this plea bargain and push for a harsher penalty, Polanski fled to Paris, and as of this show's initial airing, he has not returned to the United States since.
You ran away.
Well, I, as you say, ran away because I think that I was very unfortunate to have a judge who misused justice.
In 1969, during the summer in which she was killed, Sharon Tate left a copy of a Thomas Hardy novel on Polanski's nightstand with a note suggesting it would make a good film. Polanski would make that film, titled Tess, in 1979, and he dedicated it to Sharon. 7 years later, he helmed the biggest critical and financial disappointment of his career, Pirates, but rebounded quickly with a tense and terrific thriller starring Harrison Ford, titled Frantic.
You were in the shower when this person called your wife, is that right?
Yes.
So you didn't actually hear any of their conversation?
No, none of it. They spoke for a moment, and then she went downstairs to meet him.
Meet him?
Yes, meet him. And when they left the hotel, he had his arm around her. You know what
Walker.
It means to me? He had his arm around her? Here, like this. He could have had a gun. Like this. Here. Pointed right at her. Shut up. Smile. Walk. Up, love. Huh? Like this, huh?
Yes. Yes, it could mean that. Or they could have just been having a good time.
Mr. Shaft, you're talking about my wife. You must be thinking about yours.
Polanski and his current wife, Emmanuelle Seigner, began their relationship after working together on Frantic. He would also cast her in the psychosexual thriller Bitter Moon, co-starring Hugh Grant, and the pulpish supernatural thrill ride The Ninth Gate, starring Johnny Depp. In 1994, he directed the filmed adaptation of Ariel Dorfman's stage play Death and the Maiden, and cast Sigourney Weaver as a housewife who must confront the demons of her past in the form of Ben Kingsley, who plays a man who may or may not be the sadistic doctor who tortured Weaver's character while she was a political prisoner during the rule of a Latin American country's fascist regime.
Look at me. Isn't it bright enough to see me? Don't you know me? Didn't you tell me your ugly thoughts? Didn't you tell me your secrets?
Yes.
Didn't you rape me?
Yes.
How many times?
Many times. I raped you many times. 14 times.
In a 2000 interview with Charlie Rose, Polanski stated that he had not yet made his masterpiece, but the project he was currently working on could be just that. That film was The Pianist, the most personal exploration of the horrors of the war and the Holocaust that Polanski had ever attempted. The film won Adrian Brody an Oscar for Best Actor, and finally garnered Polanski the honor that had thus far eluded him on two previous occasions.
And the Oscar goes for Roman Polanski.
Polanski followed his Oscar win with a tepidly received adaptation of Oliver Twist, and a political mystery thriller titled The Ghost, starring Pierce Brosnan and Ewan McGregor, which is set for release sometime in 2010.
The one decision I made in 10 years as Prime Minister, which wasn't in the interests of the USA.
Hello? Who are you? I'm your ghost.
Yes, it's quite a career and quite a life. And there it is in 12 minutes.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Yeah, and The Ghost is set for release in 2010, and a statement was made on Friday
right.
that it would be released with or without Polanski's involvement. I say
right.
that for the benefit of those listening on archive in the weeks and months and possibly years in the future.
Right.
This past week has been a real doozy for
Polanski. Yeah, it has.
First of all, let me make it clear. We've been planning this show for about a month, and all the interviews that you hear involved in the show, with the exception of Keith Ulick, a critical roundtable of his work, were conducted before this event took place. Last Saturday, Polanski was arrested in Switzerland,
mm-hmm.
He's awaiting extradition to the U.S. as we're doing this show currently. Now, this has... in big part, it has something to do with a movie. Since we are a film appreciation show, a film commentary show, I wanted to bring this up. In 2008, Marina Zinovich made a documentary called Roman Polanski Wanted and Desired, which was an examination of the Polanski case from 31 years ago and possible misdealings within the judicial system and the handling of that case. Now, this documentary has made news for obvious reasons this past week, but for two in particular. One, a story has come out that one of the major figures in that documentary, one of the talking heads, claims that he wasn't entirely truthful as to the facts he revealed in the film.
Right.
The second thing that has made news regarding this film is a revelation that was first announced during this upcoming interview we're going to play from Brett Ratner, where he said that he is producing the sequel to Roman Polanski Wanted and Desired in collaboration with Marina, because this case has taken on a bigger dimension. Now, he's been working on this for months with Marina. It's not a capitalization off of the previous week's events, just to make
right.
that very clear. But we actually spoke to Marina last year, January of 2008, as she was traveling to Sundance to premiere Roman Polanski, Wanted and Desired. And we wanted to give you a little sense of what she had to say during that interview. Here's Marina.
Roman was totally exceptional. Already an established film director, everybody knew him.
He was the Roman Polanski.
The future was his. We saw, and then everything just collapsed.
He didn't perceive having intercourse with a 13-year-old girl is against the law.
The fact of Polanski leaving the country seems to have eclipsed what actually happened to the system of justice.
The judge was enjoying the publicity, and he didn't care about what happened to me, and he didn't care about what happened to Polanski.
Not much to tell you, except that I'm innocent.
Rittenband was known as a hammer. He was a tough sentencer. If you didn't make a deal, you were in trouble.
In France, he's desired, and in America, he's wanted.
That there was an article in the LA Times. It was January 2003. The article was, if Polanski gets nominated for The Pianist, will he be able to come back? And then I thought, oh, I remember this story, and I'd always been a Polanski fan, and then the girl and her lawyer ended up going on the Larry King show, and her lawyer said something that really stuck with me, which was, the day Roman Polanski fled was a sad day for the American judicial system. And I was like, what? That doesn't make sense. So it's like these ideas just kind of, they capture you almost, and you can't shake them.
Yeah.
And then I found out that I knew someone who knew the DA in the case, And I think he was going to be hard to get to because he was retired, and then I knew someone who happened to be Roman Polanski's godson. And then these little signs show up, and you're like, oh, God, here's another 5 years. You know? But, I mean, I just was fascinated with this story, and it was really something that I found that so many people have opinions about. So many people think they know exactly what happened. And a lot of people don't. I mean, there was a whole story about the judicial kind of maneuvering behind the scenes that no one really knows. And I, after a lot of kind of sweet-talking and begging and, you know, sweet-talking and begging, basically, I thought everyone to talk, everyone except Polanski, because I'd never really approached Polanski until the end because I didn't really know what he would say. I felt that it was very much a story that the lawyers who were there dealing with the now deceased judge, they were the only ones who could really tell the story.
Right.
So,
right.
Did
you get any reaction from Polanski when you finally went to him?
He met with me, I think, because he was, you know, probably astounded that I'd spent so much time kind of researching and interviewing so many people about this. I mean, I asked him if he wanted to be interviewed, and it was interesting. He said that he thought it would look like self-promotion, and you know what? He's right. So I don't think that we need Roman in the movie. I went to him because, of course, I would love to interview him, but I think the movie stands on its own without him, and he's throughout the film. I mean, it's really a film about something that happened 30 years ago, so it's an archival film. So
yeah.
There's a lot of archive of him, his voice, his image, and it's not a present-day film. It's not a biography. It doesn't go through all his movies and his life.
Right. Even so, I mean, we were discussing before you came on. I can't think of a filmmaker with a life that's been so kind of tortured and celebrated at the same time. And at the time of this incident, he had this was a few years after the Manson incident.
Right.
He was kind of hot again with Chinatown, wasn't he?
Yeah. She died in 69. Chinatown was 74.
74, yeah.
And then this happened in 77.
Oh, 77.
Yeah.
So what? I know you interviewed. Did you interview the girl?
I did.
What's her feeling for Polanski now, and how has that changed over the years?
Well, I think it's a sad story for everyone involved. You know, I think it was a mistake, and everyone's had to live with it in their own ways. She publicly forgave him, and that was part of the reason that I wanted to make the film, because I didn't know why. She seems to have dealt with it and just wants to move on with her life, and has. You know, it's just something that gets brought up, and then she gets the phone calls, and then I think what she doesn't like is, it's almost like the two of them are living in some sort of, they're stuck in some electronic hell or something, because it's really, people just really seem to gravitate towards the real sensational. I mean, how can you not? But there's another story here, and that's the story that I was trying to tell.
Okay.
I tried to, sorry?
So I wanted to get to what that story was, because we all know the what we've been told for the past 30 years, that he was accused of statutory rape, he fled to Europe to avoid imprisonment, and he's been there for 30 years.
But that's wrong. See, you have your facts wrong, because everyone does. He was in jail, but everybody thinks that he fled because he was afraid to go to jail. And that's wrong. He did go. So that, I mean, I remember when Michael Jackson was arriving at the courthouse, and of course I was watching it. I mean, wasn't everyone? And people were talking about different celebrity cases, and CNN, I think, gave some wrong facts about Polanski. It's like everyone gets this wrong.
Well, that's
why
everyone is under this false impression, and that's why your movie so fascinating. This is what I've been told for, that I've read for the past 30 years what occurred. So is it all in the legal system and the wranglings in the legal system?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's about, I mean, despite what Polanski did, and, you know, I never try to lessen the seriousness of what his crime was. Polanski pled guilty to unlawful sexual intercourse and went to jail and was under the impression that his time would be the time served. Mm-hmm. It's only what happened when he went to that jail and how he was released from the jail, which made the judge unhappy, and then the judge wanted to send him back. I mean, it's very much a story of the backroom maneuvers, the inner workings of, you know, the judicial system.
Yeah, that's Marina Zinovich, the director of Roman Polanski Wanted and Desired, speaking to us on the eve of that film Sundance premiere in January 2008.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great movie.
It really is.
All right, which brings us to our next guest. Now, you may know Brett Ratner as the director of the highly successful Rush Hour trilogy, The Family Man, X-Men The Last Stand, Red Dragon, and After the Sunset. You may have even read about his upcoming projects, including New York, I Love You, and a fourth installment of the Beverly Hills Cop series, which we asked him about. We didn't let him get away without asking about
that. That's right.
What you may not know is that Brett Ratner and Roman Polanski share an unlikely but close friendship that dates back to the first Rush Hour film back in 1998. And in this interview, Mr. Ratner discusses that friendship and his appreciation of Mr. Polanski as a man and as an artist. I know that, above all, you're a student of film. So my first question is, when did your awareness of Polanski's work begin for you?
Oh, God. I mean, I can't even remember, but it was definitely around... I mean, I was 16 when I went to NYU Film School. So I think Rosemary's Baby was probably the first, and Chinatown. Mm-hmm. I can't remember which order. And then once I was in film school, then I started to discover Cul-de-Sac and Le Locataire, which is, you know, The Tenant.
Mm-hmm.
And his earlier work. But, you know, I've been a fan of his since I can remember, loving movies. Yeah, so, but my favorite, if you ask me what my favorite film of his, I think my favorite film is The Tenant. Is by far the Tenant, yeah. And I've seen that on the big screen maybe at least 5 times on the big screen.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned The Tenant.
Yeah.
Because I recall seeing Rosemary's Baby and just being completely terrified by it as a teenager. But my most vivid first memory of Polanski's work was seeing the trailer for The Tenant. And it has always been my all-time favorite trailer, because
the trailer is brilliant, but it's also the poster is haunting. And
yes,
it's
it is.
And when you go back and look at Repulsion and you look at all his other movies, you're like, wow, you know, I think that's what makes Roman the great director that he is that when you see his film, you don't have to see literally directed by Roman Polanski. You know it's a Roman Polanski film.
That's right.
And I think that Roman's, you know, Roman's personality and his optimism, okay, I would say, exists in his work. You know, Roman is an incredibly optimistic individual, and his positivity kind of is in those movies and his life experiences. But if you ask him if any of these, you know, I asked him personally, I said, is Chinatown a personal film? Because I love the movie. Obviously, it's one of the greatest movies ever made. But
mm-hmm.
what in it is personal to you? He says, that wasn't personal, Brett. I needed a job.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
So he said the only personal film he's ever really made is The Pianist.
Not only, obviously, are you a student of Polanski's work, but you're close friends with him as well.
Yeah.
So how did that start? How did that relationship
Well, begin? I think it was Jeff Berg. I had done the first Rush Hour, and I think Jeff Berg had a conversation with Roman, and Roman had told him how much he loved Rush Hour, the first Rush Hour, and I was so surprised, you know, because, you know, I was always kind of envious of guys like Paul Thomas Anderson in a positive way, so happy for him. Paul was friendly with Jonathan Demme, and he was on the set of Kubrick's movie because he was going to work with Tom Cruise. Because I admire filmmakers. It's like the biggest star in the world could be sitting next to me in a restaurant, and if there's a director, you know, on the other side, I'm going to spend my whole time talking to the director because I just admire and love filmmakers. I was always envious of Paul because Paul had these incredible relationships with these great filmmakers, and I thought, well, one day I'm going to have to do an important film, you know, that I'm going to get the respect and I'm going to become friends with these guys that I always admired and looked up to. And when I did Rush Hour, I got three calls, and one was, you know, one was from Demme, Jonathan Demme, who told me how much he loved Rush Hour. The other one was Warren Beatty.
Yeah, he loved that film.
Yeah, and the third person who Jeff Berg introduced me to was Roman, and we had the most incredible conversation. And he said to me, "Well, are you ever in Paris?" I said, "Yeah, I come to Paris, but meanwhile, I never come to Paris." And he said, "Well, when you're in Paris, look me up." And I said, "Great." And so, like 3 weeks later, I booked a ticket, and I'll never forget this because I checked in alone to this hotel called the Royal Monceau. I checked into this hotel. And I was so excited. I was nervous. I called his office and left a message with his secretary because he wasn't around. And she said she'll give him the message. I said, "Please tell him I'm at the Royal Monceau. I'm in town for a few days." And he left a message, you know, and I wasn't going to leave my hotel room because I was so nervous to miss him. But I knew my mom would have killed me if I went to Paris and didn't go see the Louvre or go see the Eiffel Tower, you know. So I went on a walking around Paris, and when I got back to the hotel, there was those little, in Paris, in the hotels, they leave you like a little piece of paper with a handwritten note, and it said, and I actually framed it when I got it. It said, "Mr. Polanski called, please meet him at Chez André at noon."
Wow.
And so I went to the concierge and said, "Is there any poster stores around here, French poster stores?" And they said, "Yes." Yeah. So I went down to the poster store like at 9 in the morning, waited for it to open, and got every single Polanski poster I could find. And what was incredible was, though, and what unfortunate at the same time, was that the posters in Paris, I don't know if you know, they're like six sheets. They're like gigantic, right?
True.
And the restaurant I went to meet him in, the table was like the size of like a kid's desk in a preschool. They're like these tiny little tables. And I said, "Look," I saw him, and I said, "Hi, great to meet you." I said, "Listen, I don't know if I'm ever going to meet you again, so can you sign these posters for me?" And I just started opening up these posters. And I said, "Well, what do you want me to write?" I said, "To your favorite director, Fred, to your good friend, Brett." And I literally spent all day with him just picking his brain and asking questions. And I remember I told him, I said, you know, there was a scene he was asking me all these questions about Rush Hour and how did you do this and how much he loved the pace and the composition of the shots and the way the film was put together. And he said, and I was so surprised only because I realized at that moment that directors aren't snobs, meaning they're not like critics. Directors love a good film no matter what the genre was, where a movie like Rush Hour is kind of looked down upon as critics as kind of, as a pop movie, where a filmmaker like Roman, who, you know, is as credible as it gets, as a fan of movies as much as any critic, loved the movie and loved the way and appreciated how well it was made. So not to blow smoke up my own butt, but I just realized at that moment that I'm never going to really care what a critic ever says because this is all I need. The fact that Roman Polanski likes Rush Hour, you know, I don't care what any critic ever says about those movies. And so we had a great time that day, and we exchanged numbers, and we literally just kept in touch. And he invited me to the set of, I'll never forget, to the Oliver Twist movie he did.
Mm-hmm.
I flew to Prague, and that's where I met Pavel Edelman, who shot The Pianist and who shot that movie for him and is shooting Roman's current movie. And he came to New York for me and shot a segment of New York, I Love You. I've never worked with such a brilliant cinematographer. I mean, Dante shot my movies, and Dante is unbelievable. But Pavel, you know, just has an incredible sensibility and sensitivity. And his exposures and everything were just so unbelievable. I mean, I put him nose to nose with Dante Spinotti.
I'm wondering, you had to have had some preconceived notions about what you would find with Polanski when you finally met him. How did he surprise you when you met him?
Well, he surprised me because of his enthusiasm and love of movies. I didn't know he wasn't going to be that guy, but because of the life that he's had and just the tragedy, you expect maybe a guy who can
very morose.
Yeah, maybe morose, and he is the most positive, the most happiest, the most outgoing, most fun human being I've ever met. He doesn't carry his tragedy on his shoulder.
No.
He doesn't wear it like an albatross around his neck. He really is a guy who is a perfect example of humanity, of just the human spirit, of a guy who, you know, has overcome. I mean, he really is inspiring to me, not only as a filmmaker, but as a father. He's an unbelievable father.
Mm-hmm.
He's an unbelievable man. He's just a guy who really shows me that, you know, there's ups and downs in life, and that, you know, a human being overcome tragedy
yeah.
in their life and
right.
still make a great life for themselves. So, you know, at the same time that he has some dark themes in his movies, you know, and he's not cynical or tries to over intellectualize it. We laugh about, you know, like his movies and what people say of them, the deeper meaning that they look at into his films, and it's funny of his point of view, and he was just like, he's trying to tell a great story,
mm-hmm.
you know, and whether it comes out to be great or whether whatever the deeper meaning people find, that's okay, but it's kind of, I think he finds it humorous that people believe that he intellectualizes it. He's the guy who always says, and I feel the same way in the way I work as a filmmaker. He always says, "Brett, I use my eye and instincts.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. I don't use my brain as much as I do my eye and my instincts." Not to say that his movies aren't smart, but he's an incredibly intelligent person, and he just
mm-hmm.
he's a born storyteller. So I got to tell you a great story. So we have this friendship, and I was offered to be the president of the jury of the Camera Image Film Festival in Poland, which is in Łódź, Poland. And when I was in NYU Film School, I had a Polish film professor by the name of Milek Knebel.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that if I wanted to be a great director, I had to go to the film school in Łódź, Poland, which is where Roman went. And I said, okay, well, sign me up. I'm ready to move to Poland. You know, I was in NYU. I was in film school. He says, okay, but first you have to take 6 months of Polish. And I was like, why don't you teach me what they teach you in that school? Because you're from that school. So I didn't end up going. And then 20 years later, I'm invited to be the president of the jury of this cinematography film festival, which is the most prestigious film festival for cinematographers in Poland, in Łódź, in the town. And I call Rome and I say, guess where I'm going? To Łódź. He goes, what do you mean you're going to Łódź? I said, he said, I went to film school there. I said, I know. He said, well, I'm going to be the president of this jury there. And he said, I'm coming to meet you. So to my surprise, Roman flew from Paris to Warsaw and then drove, I don't know if it's like 2 hours, 2.5 hours, to Łódź.
Mm-hmm.
Met me in Łódź on the last day of the film festival and took me to his film school that he hadn't been in probably over 30 years and took me into this classroom, which was a screening room,
mm-hmm.
and showed me all of his student films.
Wow.
Wow.
And that was the most incredible experience, I mean, really, of my life. I mean, and then we left there, and we went to Poland. We went to Auschwitz. He took me we went to Auschwitz. We were in Poland. We went to Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed me where his mother was murdered
mm-hmm.
in Auschwitz. And it was an incredibly emotional trip. And I actually took pictures of it for He magazine. It wasn't for He, but I took pictures and I gave them to He magazine. And I took Alan Hughes with me, who's one of the Hughes brothers,
mm-hmm.
who's
yeah.
a big fan of Romans, and we all kind of all hang out, the three of us. And then we went to Krakow, and he showed me where he was born, his grandmother's house and his house. So it was great. It was such a great experience, and it was educational. It was definitely an emotional journey, but for me it was an experience that I'll never forget for the rest of my life. I actually videotaped it, but I put videotapes in the vault because I'll never let that out. But just such a great experience for me.
Let me ask you about, because you mentioned that you've been invited to his sets to watch him work on Oliver Twist and The Ghost, his latest one.
Yes.
What do you take from him? What do you learn from him observing him in working mode?
Oh my God. I went on the set of The Ghost in Berlin. I mean, yeah, I was in Berlin. I went to visit him on the set of The Ghost. I was there. I was only there for a day.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, God, I mean, you know, he's a, like I said, when you see his short films, he was born to do this.
Mm-hmm.
This guy was born to do this. And I think from our generation, of course, there's great directors that go back. But for me, you know, there's Kubrick, then there's Polanski, and everyone else kind of falls under that. And Roman
right.
is still alive. So of the living directors, he's, I think, the greatest of the living directors. And I, like I said, what he does has, which makes him who is he has an unbelievable point of view. He knows what he wants. And, you know, he is a great actor. And that's why I love the rest of acting in movies. When John Huston
mm-hmm.
was in Chinatown,
right.
The Rush Hour 3, and we were having lunch.
Okay.
And I was telling him about the movie, and I said, as a joke, I'm always saying, you know, and I said, Roman, you should be in the film. And he goes, well, what would I do? I'm in New York City. That's why there's signs everywhere.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah. And so I said, he said, well, what would I do? And I said, hold, wait right here. And I go to the bathroom and I call my writer, Jeff Nathanson, who wrote Catch Me If You Can and wrote all the Rush Hour movies. And I
right.
said, Jeff, I said, you got to write a scene for Roman Polanski. He goes, Roman Polanski is not acting in Rush Hour 3. I said, I swear he's going to do it. Just write a scene. And I said, fax it over to the hotel. So we finished lunch, and by the time we walked to the hotel, the concierge says, Monsieur Retina, I have a fax for you. And I hand Roman the script. I don't even read it because I know Jeff's a great writer. And he writes a scene as a cop that welcomes Chris and Jackie when he arrives in Paris. And he said, I'm in. And I was like, oh, my God. I was so excited. One day Roman calls me, and he's so meticulous about his character, about his hair, his mustache, his wardrobe, you know, the way that the badge, the details on the props that he uses. That attention to detail is what makes him one of the greats.
Yes.
That's what separates the wheat from the chaff. When you ask me, the way he works is his attention to detail is unbelievable.
Right.
And even as an actor, he does that. His process, his method. The greatest day of my life, aside from the day that I met him, was when he calls me up and he says, can I see you? He's going to say, oh, I changed my mind. I'm not going to do the movie. And he says, where are you? I said, I'm at the Plaza Athenae. He said, I'll meet you in the lobby. Meets me in the lobby, and he says, can we rehearse? And I'm like, oh, right here? He goes, yeah. So I'm sitting there running lines with Roman Polanski, and I'm saying to myself, can someone see me right now? I'm running lines with Roman Polanski. This is the director.
Yeah, that's got to be awesome.
And I'm the director. So it was so cool. It was so cool.
He's such an amazing talent, obviously, and we talk endlessly in these interviews we've done the past week about his strength of composition and his framing.
That's what it's all about, I think. I mean, you know, obviously he's so great with actors. He's so great with, you know, and his secret is also something that it's something that I do as well, is he hires the best people in the world. If you look at the editors he work with and the cinematographers, I mean, they were the best in the world, really. And his composition to me is what the thing that blows me away, his sense of the frame.
Mm-hmm.
His sense of the frame. And he has this Pee-wee viewfinder, which is this old-school viewfinder that they don't make anymore. They haven't made it probably in 30 years. It's like the coolest thing ever that he wears around his neck. I found one on the Internet, and I bought it. It's like, you know, the coolest thing ever. But it's that shot in Rosemary's Baby. I mean, every shot. There's not a shot that doesn't punch you in the face in one of his movies. There's
right.
not a shot that doesn't have importance. He's not over-covering anything. He's not showing off. It's always to serve the story. He's always... Every frame serves the story, and there's not a wasted frame in his movies.
And it sounds like an obvious statement, but film is a visual medium, and if you turn the volume down in his films, you can follow them perfectly through the visual.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Incredible.
That's still a knife in the water, I always found.
Yeah. Well, even in his student films, I'll tell you, you have to see them. And they are brilliant. I think on one of the cul-de-sac DVD, you could see all his shorts, I think, for the Criterion Collection. And I just watched the new release that Criterion just put out of Repulsion.
Yeah, I just bought that on Blu-ray.
And it's incredible, the behind the scenes, I mean, stuff, and the making of is like some of the greatest stuff I've ever seen. And his commentary and his interviews about the movie, about the making of the movie, I mean, and why he made certain choices, and why, you know, he would say certain. I love that there were some shots that he said, "Look, if I was doing that today, I would never do that. It was too pretentious, or too I don't know the words he would use, but he was always kind of." Still kind of, you know, he doesn't consider his work, and that's what it is. He doesn't think of it as a masterpiece, but even though it is, he sees the flaws in it. Mm-hmm. He sees how he could have done better. There's a shot of Catherine Deneuve that was sitting in the park in the distance, and it was too far, the lens. So the one lesson he taught me is about distance. And I saw that in Repulsion, he points out, I don't know if it was in the commentary or he was talking about the scene where the Catherine Deneuve was too far, and there was a car, a big car that passed through the frame, and everyone's eye went to the car, and I could see why he was giving me that whole speech when I first met him the first day. I said, what advice are you going to tell me? I was saying, tell me something, because he kept asking me questions. And I'm like, but you're Roman Polanski, you got to give me something. And he's like, remember the distance. Forget about the lens you use. The distance between you, the camera, and the subject. Mm-hmm. And we work very similarly, where I let the actors block and let them go with their instincts, and then I stand where I want the camera to be.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, his approach, and I did that as well without knowing that he did that, but that's how I kind of figure out where I want to start a scene. And when we were together in Paris the first time, I said I had a tough time in this one scene figuring out where to start the scene. I think that's sometimes the hardest thing. And it was like sitting there, trying to figure out a math test with a calculator sitting with him, because I drew it. He said, okay, who's in the scene and where are they standing? And then he showed me where he would put the camera, which is the complete different place where I would have put it, where I did put it. And then he asked me, well, where did you put the camera? And he gave me so much confidence, because he said, you see, that's totally personal. Mm-hmm. There's no right or wrong here.
Yeah.
It's just really about personal taste.
Right.
And that's the thing about Roman, is that he has the best taste of any filmmaker I've ever seen, because his choices are so smart and so specific and so thought out. They're not; it's not random.
What do you think his legacy is?
Well, his legacy is his body of work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know if it's one movie. It's not one. I mean, there are so many great films that he's made, and so many people love so many different movies. Someone will say, one person will say Repulsion is their favorite. One person will say Rosemary's Baby. Another person will say Chinatown. So
Right. Everybody
has their different opinion. I think the legacy is his body of work.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you've seen the documentary Wanted and Desired.
It's a great, great documentary.
Yeah. So Marina, you know, Roman had nothing to do with that movie. He didn't even see the movie. I actually saw the movie. We had a screening. Marina screened the movie at my house, and I invited Roman's friends like Bob Evans and Warren Beatty. I think Bob Town was there. I don't remember, but a bunch of his friends came to see the movie before Roman even saw it, and because he didn't really want to sway anyone's opinion. He wanted it to be an honest depiction of what happened, and I think Marina did a brilliant job. So now Marina's asked me to produce the sequel to Wanted and Desired, because so much has happened because of that film.
Yeah.
And now probably the case is going to go to the Supreme Court, and so much is going to happen now. And so I am so lucky, and I think Marina is such a brilliant filmmaker. She won an Emmy for Best Director and I think Best Writer, but she did a brilliant job, and I'm lucky to be working with her. So I'm producing the sequel to Wanted and Desired.
Oh, that's amazing!
Oh, that's great news. That's wonderful.
You know, Roman will be a part of it. I mean, I think now because now it's really more about the outcome of what's happened since.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Roman has agreed to participate.
It seems to me that he would probably choose to stay at the place where he's made his home in France, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't really get into those details. I mean, he has a great life. He has a great family. I think to clear his, I think for peace of mind, I think, you know, this case has just been going on too long, and it's just ridiculous. And
yeah.
the injustice of the judicial system is
right.
so obvious in Marina's film. So I don't think it's about a desire to come back to the United States. I think it's more about peace of mind for him.
Yeah,
and I think
right.
that, and that's something that I think he deserves. And I think the family's forgiven him, the girl, the victim, forgiven him.
Yeah.
The rest of the world should forgive them. It's give him. It's not his business. And
right.
the LA judicial system is corrupt. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's horrible.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
I think I would love to see that happen for just his peace of mind. It would be great.
Before I let you go, can I just,
yeah.
I've been waiting 2 years to relay this message to you. We had Judge Reinhold on the show like a year and a half ago.
So
he
cool.
went on for 10 minutes about where he'd like to, if his character Billy is a part of the fourth Beverly Hills Cop, where he'd like to see Billy going. Is he a part of Beverly Hills Cop 4, the Billy character?
There's been a few variations of it. I mean, I would love him to be a part of it, and I think so would Eddie. So, yeah, we're trying to figure that out. I actually called him, and he never called me back, which is weird.
No
maybe
kidding.
Maybe I called the wrong number, but I would love to hear his idea. I mean, I know Eddie's open to it, and so am I. If it happens, it depends on, you know, when you're writing a script, there's rewrites, there's ideas, there's changes,
right.
there's variations. But, yeah, I would love to work with him. I think he's a part of as much a part of the Beverly Hills Cop legacy as Eddie is. So
right.
It would be great, and he's a great actor.
Mm-hmm. I will send you the audio. I'll send your people the audio.
Will you send it to me? That would be
yeah,
great.
Yeah, we will, definitely.
I would love to hear it, and I'll play it for Eddie, too. Thanks, you know, for this tribute. I think it's important, you know, for people to you know, support, you know, great films and great filmmakers. And I think you guys are obviously fans of movies. And I just think that Roman is just one of the greats. And he deserves all the respect and adulation that he receives. And I'm lucky just to know him and honored to be his friend. But the truth is I'm more of a fan. You know, I'm just his biggest,
yeah.
biggest fan.
Right.
And
oh, yeah.
he dispels all, I mean, when I meet a director and a director starts acting like a snob or an asshole or something, I'm like, oh, my God. I mean,
right.
Roman is the most down-to-earth, the most friendly, the most real, the most, you know, and at the same time, the most respected, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so why act like an asshole when, you know, he's the poster child for the you know, a nice person, you know? He's just...
Right.
There's nothing pretentious about him. There's nothing. He's so down to earth and such a great person that when I meet somebody who has a lot of success and they start acting like they're important or they have self-importance,
right,
I
right.
just I get so turned off because when you meet a guy like Roman who could act that way if he wanted to, he's just a regular guy, really, who just loves movies as much or more than any person I've ever met. It's not just that he's a filmmaker. He loves films. I got him the Janus collection for a present, and he, you know, his daughter told me that he watches it like every night. He puts in one of those movies,
one
of those classic films, and he watches it because he loves films. And I think that's what our relationship. You say, what the hell is Brett Ratner and Roman Polanski doing as friends? But the thing is, we both have a love and a passion for movies, and I think that's what our connection is.
Right.
You know, I think, and I have a love and admiration for legends, for old guys, because I'm going to learn from these guys.
Yeah.
These guys have been through it, you know, they've experienced it. And I want to learn from them. And that's why I seek these people out and I try to, you know, cultivate my relationships with them and stay in touch with them because I love hearing their stories and they love to tell their stories.
Okay, that's Brett Ratner talking to us about Polanski. It was a nice interview. It was a nice conversation we had.
Yeah, it was. It was very nice.
And, excuse me, we're starting a petition to get Judge Reinhold cast in the fourth Beverly Hills Cop. So any support our listeners could give us in that direction.
Yeah.
Now, this interview, it's probably the most high-profile interview we've done because it's of the press it's received
mm-hmm.
prior to airing tonight. I mean, Variety and Entertainment Weekly and New York Post and a lot of outlets have run with some of the revelations that Ratner shared.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
From this interview. And, of course, I need to repeat, it was conducted a few hours before Polanski's arrest on Saturday.
That's right.
Concerning, and some of the coverage has been just flat out incorrect.
Insultingly incorrect.
Yeah, in terms of what Ratner had to say. So now the whole interview, the entire interview is out there, so there's no question as to what he said. But even so, Mr. Ratner provided us with a statement concerning some of the content of his interview with us, and I'd like to share it with you guys now. He writes, and I quote, "I wish to clarify my previous comments on the Polanski matter so there is no misunderstanding as to what I meant. When Roman pled guilty in 1978, the prosecution, the judge, and the defendant all agreed to the sentence. But after he entered his plea, Roman learned that the judge did not intend to honor the previously negotiated deal that triggered his plea. This is what I was referring to when I recently said the judicial system seemed corrupt in this case. It was not my intention to discredit the present California legal system or the district attorney's office." So that's from Brett Ratner concerning his conversation with us. All right, let's get to let's go from the present to the past in Mr. Polanski's career and examine some of his most influential films. And let's start with you, Jerry. What are some of your favorite Polanski films and why?
Well, I think The Chinatown is really the most influential one, and it's really funny because, you know, I saw Rosemary's Baby as a very young child in elementary school, and it's really the end where I think we actually played the scene. You know, forgive me because it's been many years, almost many decades since I've seen the film, but where she's telling the other person, you're doing it wrong, essentially. You know, at the very end, you know, it's a,
yes.
She's a mother. And, you know, she's telling the older woman, you're doing it wrong. And that always stood out for me, but it's really Chinatown. I came from the school of thought in my junior high and high school that Robert Towne's script for Chinatown is considered the greatest screenplay ever written.
Without a doubt.
With the most perfect. Nothing else even comes close. This is the, you know, before we got all these horrible screenwriting books that taught us formula, Chinatown was the script. That was the thing that you went to. That's where you learned how to write a script. Now, after that, I still to this day say that is Jack Nicholson's finest performance. I am taking everything in consideration when I say that. That is Jack Nicholson at the top of his game. But more importantly, it is Roman Polanski at the top of his game. Chinatown is the single greatest film about Los Angeles. And I take into consideration Alan Rudolph's Welcome to L.A. when I say that. I take into consideration Lisa Cholenko's Laurel Canyon. Chinatown is the be-all, end-all of Los Angeles cinema.
Yeah.
It is perfect.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned screenwriting and formula, because here is a film that takes off on a genre that is very formulaic, the film noir crime genre, and it turns a lot of elements on its head. Just to make a film, a thriller in that vein, and have it be about water.
Is
ballsy. Secondly, the kind of femme fatale, she has set up Faye Dunaway's character as a femme fatale, and eventually it morphs into she is the heroine of the piece.
Yeah.
There's a lot of elements of this film that are very unique, and I saw a making of this film recently, and it's a good point in terms of Polanski's style. He takes time with things.
Yes, he does.
He takes a lot of time with Chinatown, and with a movie like Frantic. I read an interview with Harrison Ford where he said, "You know, I know this is a thriller, and it's called Frantic, but it's not frantically paced. You should call it you should call it mildly disturbing."
Yeah, no, he's right. That's a good point.
But that's it. There's a patience and a building of the reality of these scenes that he creates. It's very unique for these movies. Chinatown is, without a doubt, you can't dismiss that as one of the great films of all time. Rosemary's Baby, I remember, I was very taken by it when I was younger, and then I rediscovered it 6 or 7 years ago. And I remember playing it for a friend, and the end, the whole Satan lives kind
yeah,
of
yeah.
That's the off the wall ending. And my friend couldn't stay in the room. He said, "Oh, I'm too disturbed." he had to walk outside.
Remember, they made a sequel to Rosemary's Baby called "Whatever Happened to Rosemary's Baby?" Do you remember that?
Directed by our next guest, yeah.
Yeah, there's that, and there was a book that Ira Levin wrote, a book called "Son of Rosemary" back in I think '98 or '99, which you know it was very horribly written book. Actually, I read it, and it's awful. It negates the whole entire first film, but
yeah.
Now Rosemary's Baby is very important because you could never have The Omen, The Exorcist. I think you couldn't have The Exorcist even.
Well, we talk about this. I talk about this a little bit later with Keith.
Yeah.
And so I'll save it for that conversation. But the specific tone that Polanski gives Rosemary's Baby,
mm-hmm.
when it could have just as easily been complete and total schlock.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
movie.
Totally.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, I mean, I've always been a fan of the kind of the unadulterated craziness of A Bitter Moon.
Mm-hmm.
I've always loved Death and the Maiden, which I think was tailor-made for someone of Polanski's particular skills.
Mm-hmm.
It's very claustrophobic, very intense, very psychological. And I'm a big fan of Frantic and a big fan of The Tenet, as
mm-hmm.
Mr. Ratner.
All great films, and I'll add Repulsion to that list, but I really
have
to add...
Of course.
I would add The Pianist.
Yes.
And the reason I would, and I got into a lot of trouble many years ago, I did say in a locker room of a gym in Los Angeles after that came out that is far superior to Schindler's List.
Now defend that.
Because Schindler's List is a great film. It is a magnificent film. But it is the beginning of the end of the Holocaust genre. In a sense, it is an Americanized version of the Holocaust.
Okay.
I think it's a great film. I think there are truths in that film that Spielberg, you didn't think he ever had the balls to express that in a movie. Maybe in his personal life. But there are certain scenes that film brings. But Polanski, being a child of Holocaust victims, is a European film, and let me be very honest when I say this: the Holocaust is a European disaster, not an American one. Regardless of how many of your bookstores have a Holocaust section in it, it is not an American thing. It is a European thing that everyone knew in Europe was going on, and The Pianist makes that perfectly clear. It is.
Right.
I do think it is Polanski's masterpiece in the later part of his career. It is honest, it is vile, it is disturbing, and it is Adrian Brody at his very best.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. I accept your defense.
Thank you.
So let's get to some of our other guests for tonight. And first up is William A. Fraker, and he is one of the legendary talents in the film in the field of cinematography. And let me tell you something, we spoke to Mr. Fraker for over a half an hour, and we're including in the show the portion obviously that has to do with Mr. Polanski. But in our next show we will play the remainder of this interview because it's got great insights into a bunch of other films. He shot Rosemary's Baby, of course, for Polanski in 1968, and has remained an admirer of Polanski's talent for visual storytelling ever since. But that same year, 1968, he also shot Bullet, which was another groundbreaking work of cinema. The car chase alone, William Fraker shot that. His other credits include Day of the Dolphin in 1941, Looking for Mr. Goodbar, Heaven Can Wait, War Games, and Tombstone. What a career this man has had.
Oh, I know.
Very generous to share his time and his warmth with us for this interview. Here is Mr. William A. Fraker.
What have you done to it? What have you done to its eyes?
He has his father's eyes.
What are you talking about? Guy's eyes are normal. What have you done to him, you maniac?
Satan is his father, not Guy. He came up from hell and begat a son of mortal woman.
Hail Satan!
Hail Satan!
Satan is his father, and his name is Adrian. He shall overthrow the mighty and lay waste their temples. He shall redeem the despised and wreak vengeance in the name of the burned and the tortured. Hail Adrian!
Hail Adrian!
Hail Satan! Hail Satan!
You out of all the world, out of all the women in the whole world, he chose you. He ran these things because he wanted you to be the mother of his only living son.
His power is stronger than stronger. Hail his
Satan.
Might shall last longer than longer.
Hail Satan!
No! It can't be! No!
Look at his hands.
His feet! Oh, God!
You know, looking at your resume, and Rosemary's Baby came fairly early in your career.
I was very, very fortunate that time, because especially at Paramount, because I did five or six pictures in a row at Paramount during that time, and it just happened that Roman and Bill Castle, who produced the picture, did Rosemary's Baby. William Castle. Was a good director and a good producer, terrific producer, in fact, was also a director. And he bought Rosemary's Baby, actually, started with that, got Paramount to buy it. And then Bob Evans was head of Paramount at that time and loved Roman. And so he brought Roman over from Europe.
Yeah, we've covered the story of the film's conception before on the show, and it is fascinating how it came to be. Did you have an awareness of Polanski's work prior to Rosemary's Baby?
Yes, I did. We all did. You know, everybody, and Knife in the Water, and those pictures. We knew he was an important director, and he was young. He was extremely young. I loved him, and I loved him for the fact that he knew how to tell a story visually. He knew how to work the visual aspects of motion pictures. And that's what a lot of directors today don't realize. They want to be storytellers. So you have to be a storyteller, but you have to think visually. You have to think what you're giving the audience and how you want to bring the audience into the story that you're telling and keep them there.
Yeah.
That's the secret. And that was one of the great things about Roman. He knew how to tell a story visually. Like in Rosemary's Baby, when they first, the kids, Mia Farrow and John Cassavetes, when they first get to the apartment, he opens up and he's on the floor in the living room.
Mm-hmm.
And you see them come in through the hallway. First, it's just a dark room. And then the door opens and they both come in. They're carrying some stuff. And John comes in and he goes off to the left, and then Mia comes in. Now, we're on the ground with a camera, and normally what you do, because they're the actors, you tilt up with them so that you see their faces, see their expressions, and then see them exit.
Mm-hmm.
Roman says, no, you just stay on the ground, you just stay right ahead. And I said, but we only catch them at the knees when they stop here. He says, exactly. And then after they exit, he stays one, two, three, then he cuts. Now what he's doing, this is the beautiful part about Roman, what he's doing is that he's, besides Mia Farrow and John Cassavetes and Ruth Gordon and Sidney Blackmere, there's the four actors, he's made the apartment another actor.
Mm-hmm.
He's starting to. So, and the apartment is very, very important in Rosemary's Baby. We bring them into the apartment, the other couple, Sidney Blackmere and Ruth, and then we come into the front room, and they talk about the baby. She's going to have a baby and so forth. She says, "Oh, you got a telephone? I've got to call Patsy Kelly." And she says, "I've got to talk over the phone." And Mia says, "That way." And Ruth exits, camera left. Okay, now Roman says, "All right, cut." He says, "Now, Billy, give me a shot of Ruth on the bed." I said, "Okay, terrific." And so we shoot we set up the shot and we light it and so forth. And we're in the front room, which means you have one door jam. Mm-hmm. Then you have the hallway. Then you got another door jam to the bedroom. And so you see two door jams. And then you see Ruth sitting on the bed. And so I said, "Okay, Roman, we're ready. Take a look." And He looks at it and he says, no, no, Billy, no, no, no. He says, move camera left, and move the camera left. And he says, there, that's the shot. And I look through, and I said, you can only see half of her. And she says, and he says, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I you know, that's a marvelous experience to go through. And I just fell in love with him, and I still love him to this day, because he's a visual storyteller, and he's a marvelous storyteller.
Yeah, those images just burn in your brain. When you met with him to discuss the direction you were going to take with this film, what were those initial meetings and conversations like?
Well, they were absolutely terrific, and since he wrote the screenplay and knew he was going to direct, he really had a complete knowledge of exactly what he wanted. And he says, I want your contributions, Billy. He says, but remember, I'm the director. I said, yes, sir. And then there was another picture being done with Burt Reynolds, and Paramount was doing it. And they said, Billy, we want you to do this picture. And then I said, I don't want to do anything, because I don't want to miss doing Rosemary's Baby.
Uh-huh.
And they said, don't worry about it. Then the picture got postponed, and the picture got a late start, and I said, I got to do Rosemary's. I said, because the book by Ira Levin was sensational.
Oh, yeah.
The book was a killer.
Yeah, it was.
And I hadn't met Roman at that time, but I knew the material, and I said, God, this is fantastic picture. And book, and so I was just afraid that I would be stuck and miss. And I said,
yeah.
No, 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 no. And they said, yes, 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 yes.
You chose wisely. Yeah.
They said, we're the boss, Billy.
Just out of curiosity, and you, what was the Burt Reynolds movie?
I think it was. I believe it was Gator.
Okay, so that came much later. You came back to that.
Oh well, no, then it wasn't Gator. It was something else. I can't remember all.
That's
that.
All right. That's okay.
Yeah, that was.
I'm at an age. I'm at an age now where, things slip away.
Okay.
That was pre-Deliverance, so that was an early Burt Reynolds.
Yes, it was. It was pre-Deliverance.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
It would have to be. Yeah.
It was a little picture. I'll think of it. It'll come to me.
In terms of Rosemary's Baby, if I'm reading correctly, I think I read that you only used two lenses for that film.
Yes, a 20-25 and a 18, I think.
Is that unusual?
And 18. Yes. We didn't use any long lenses. And that's because if you look at the picture and look at the setups in the picture of the apartment, you'll see that apartment becomes very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
And it changes its personality. It's drab and so forth when we go into it because of the little old lady was living there. And then how it changes and gets bright and sparkly like she is and so forth like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very important aspect of the motion picture. And people don't realize it. But they're just sucked into the middle of it and they stay sucked in.
Mm-hmm.
Right. What strikes me about Mr. Polanski as well is, in spite of the tragedies that he's incurred in his life,
yeah,
he still maintains such a childlike enthusiasm for filmmaking. Did you find that to be the case?
Yeah, absolutely. He loves filmmaking. That's his life. That's his whole life. I love him, and he'll really be high in my estimation, my memory of him.
Yeah.
Very, very high. And we were going to do, we were going to do Chinatown. I was doing a commercial in Monaco, in Italy, in Rome,
mm-hmm.
and in Monaco, rather, and there was a Dodge that came out called Monaco, so they went over there to shoot it, and I got a phone call from him. And he says, Billy, we're going to do Chinatown. Take a picture with Jack Nicholson. And, oh, God, he was excited. I said, okay, I'll be home in about a week. I'll give you a call. And so I came home. I said, let's go to lunch, Roman. And he says, okay. And so we went to lunch. And then he told me, he says, you're not going to do Rosemary. You're not going to do Chinatown. I said, why? And he says, because Bob Evans, who ran the studio and was becoming a producer and leaving the studio in a sense,
mm-hmm.
for his position in the studio, he said, if Fraker and Polanski get the picture, they're going to run with it. I want some other cameraman. And it broke my heart. I was so happy.
He wanted more control over the project.
Yeah,
he did.
And then they hired Stanley Cortez, who was a magnificent cinematographer. And then he lasted a week and a half. And then John Alonzo came on.
Mm-hmm.
And John Alonzo did a magnificent job. Beautiful
gorgeous,
job.
Gorgeous movie.
Yeah. And then John now has passed away, along with Stanley.
Yeah.
But John was younger than me. John was a young cinematographer. And I knew John before he was married to Jan. And he was an actor. I knew him as an actor. Then he became a cinematographer at the same commercial company I worked for, and became a terrific cinematographer. God, very good.
He was amazing, and very, very warm, generous soul. I could tell from the interviews that I've heard from Mr. Alonzo.
He was beautiful. I love John. He was absolutely terrific.
Yeah. Mr. Polanski, when have you encountered him over the years or spoken with him?
No, I haven't. We just, through other people, tell Billy I love him.
Yeah.
I say, tell Roman I love him. But we've never spoken or anything like that. I was in doing a picture with, we were in Tunisia. And he was going to do a picture called Pirates or something down further south.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I was going to go down and see him on the weekend. And instead, they decided to shoot that weekend, and I couldn't go down and see him. And then 4 or 5 days later, during the week, we left and came home. That was the only chance I had to see him. I couldn't. And he says that... why do I want to come back to Hollywood?
Exactly.
Look what has happened to me while I was in Hollywood.
Yeah.
With Sharon Tate and with his wife.
Right.
And they were marvelous together. God, we used to go to dinner on the weekends because they lived in Malibu.
Right.
They had a place in Malibu, and we used to go to dinner down at the Malibu Pier. There was a restaurant, at the head of the pier, and then in Santa Monica. And it was just absolutely magnificent, marvelous.
Wow.
He was very loyal to people, and he was very loyal to the people he worked with. And, God, I'm trying to think of the production designer.
Silbert?
Richard Silbert, yeah, Dick
yes.
Silbert. And who was magnificent, by the way. And I mean magnificent. And because... You could take any piece of the wall and any piece of the set that he built, and you could remove a piece of the set so you could stick a camera in there. And he built for making pictures. He was a complete artist, but he was also visually inclined. He thought visually, you know.
Yes.
And so, God, I thought he was just absolutely magnificent. And he ran the studio, I thought, quite well. Eventually, he became head of Paramount.
Thank you so much, Mr. Fraker.
Well, God bless you, and God bless you for giving me the opportunity to talk about Roman, how much I love him, how much I appreciate him, and how much I really respect what he does visually. I was very, very fortunate to have the privilege of working with him, so that's one of the highlights of my life. So
I can imagine.
Great.
Okay, that's William A. Fraker, cinematography legend. And really, tune into the next show when we'll play the remainder of that interview.
It's a great interview.
We covered Day of the Dolphin. You asked about Nichols' Day of the Dolphin. And
I had to. I mean,
I couldn't help but ask him about Island of Dr. Moreau.
Well, I mean, that's a fascinating film. Well, you know, those kind of films are fascinating because you do want to be a fly on the wall doing those kind of troubled things, you know?
Yeah. Okay, we come to our next guest now, and our next guest is near and dear to all of us on this show, Bobby Osteen. Bobby is a very accomplished editor and writer whose two books dissect the art of editing in a very special way. Those two books are The Invisible Cut and Cut to the Chase, which chronicles the career of her late husband Sam Osteen, who collaborated with Polanski on several landmark films. And we spoke to Bobby about those films and the role that Sam played in crafting them. And Sam edited, he edited three Polanski films, Rosemary's Baby, Chinatown, and Frantic, correct?
And then he also worked on Tess.
Okay.
What happened was they could not release Tess because it was too long, and Claude Berry, who was was a great French director, also the producer of this film, wanted Sam to shorten it. And unfortunately, Polanski had, this is typical, he had an adventure he needed to go on, and he went hiking in Tibet, or skiing in Tibet or something, and he took off. And so Sam was waiting around for him to come back, and finally he said to the producers, "I don't want to waste your money. Let me just go home and I'll talk to him when he gets back." And he wasn't there to be with him personally and argue his case, so Polanski put a lot of that stuff back, and it was, I think, probably would have been better if they had worked together on it. It was long.
Yeah.
Beautiful, but long. So.
I understand that Sam really enjoyed Roman's way of shooting.
Right. Very challenging, but yes, he did.
He said it was like putting together a giant jigsaw puzzle or something to that effect.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the things I love, and I do love editors. I just absolutely love them, I have to say. I have so much admiration for this whole puzzle-solving aspect of editing, and that, you know, my father, I noticed this with Sam, and I noticed this with my father and a lot of editors, where they think about the cuts all the time, and they run them in their heads, and it's this constant challenge of trying to make it better. And with Polanski, the challenge was that he never shot a traditional master shot.
Hmm.
That he never let the camera sit still and just encompass the whole scene, which made the scenes very dynamic and exciting and organic and all those things. But it was sort of like a bucket of worms. If you know, people would move in and out of the frame, or the camera would move, and so there was this sort of unsettling feeling that you get from his film that was so exciting, that makes your skin crawl, makes you lean forward. But when you're cutting into a shot that's constantly changing, and by the way, changing in every take, because he would never do the same thing twice, it's very
wow.
difficult. It's like jumping on a bus while it's moving, you know?
Yeah.
So it was so exciting, and his film was so exciting. I mean, he shot a ton of film, a lot of takes. And I remember one particular scene in Frantic where he made Harrison Ford go up the steps a million times, and just a little to the left, a little to the right, just barely changing it, and not
wow.
not feeling the need to explain it either. But it's a chemistry thing. It's like falling in love, you know. You have a reaction to a director's work, and it excites you or it doesn't, you know. And,
right.
and Sam just was so enthralled with his film. He just loved to touch it, literally and figuratively, you know.
What did Sam find unique or special about Roman?
His passion.
Mm.
He's very intense, and he's very, even now, he is in his 70s, and he's like a little boy, you know.
Yeah.
He's incredible energy, and he's just passionate. They would fight passionately, and you know, he would when they were, you know, he has a certain rep for being hard on his actors, which I don't think it's that he's hard on his actors. I think he's impatient with indulging things that he doesn't think are necessary.
Right.
But I think he'll pick up a lamp and move it to the side. He won't wait for a crew member to do it. He's wonderful with his crews. He's very democratic. He's not at all an elitist or a dictator, which a lot of directors can be. So, but I think Sam just the passion. I mean, when you're working on a film and there's so much excitement and so much conviction, it's infectious, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And when he edited Frantic, was he on location with Roman, or was he back here in the States? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did the
lucky us?
Absolutely, that was a good trip. You actually examined in your book Invisible Cut two different scenes from Chinatown. The first meeting between Nicholson and Faye Dunaway, and then the big revelation scene in the last act of the film. Why did you choose those two in particular, and what did you want to express about the thinking behind editing those two scenes?
The first scene is about what's not being said, and the second scene is about what's being said. So there's a very different tone to the two scenes, tone and emotion, and that is mirrored by the editing style. So that in the first scene, the Faye Dunaway character is hiring Giddies, played by Jack Nicholson, as a detective, and she's clearly hiding something. And when he mentions Noah Cross, who's her father, who we later find out she's also an incest victim, so this is a truly evil man, we don't really know any of that yet, but we see it's all about eye contact. He's saying a lot of things to her to try to pull information out of her. And although she's not verbally revealing information, it's the way she averts her eyes. It's the way the editor... Sam is specifically zeroing in on when she looks down, when she looks away, when she nervously lights her cigarette, when she stubs out her cigarette. You know, all of these nonverbal cues are very specifically meant to telegraph to the audience what is going on with her character. So it's very subtle. And then in the second scene, when she confesses that her daughter, she's also the mother and the sister of this girl because she was an incest victim. It's a very different kind of scene because Jack Nicholson is furious at her. He thinks she murdered her husband. There's a very heated kind of energy in the editing, and there's an ebb and flow to the pace where he starts to believe her, then he doesn't, and then he slaps her. And then her confession, there were a lot of challenges with that. One of the things that I bring up in that scene is the challenge of finding the best performance in an actor, and sometimes you have to make editing choices that are not visually the best choices or the smoothest ones to protect the performance, and in this case, Faye Dunaway's confession.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's just they're so incredibly different. And yet subtly different, but very significant plot points in those two scenes that dictate the editing style.
I found these in your backyard in the pond. They belonged to your husband, didn't they? Didn't they?
I don't know. Yes, probably.
Yes, positively. It's where he was drowned.
What?
There's no time to be shocked by the truth. The coroner's report proves that he had salt water in his lungs when he was killed. Just take my word for it, all right? Now, I want to know how it happened, and I want to know why, and I want to know before Escobar gets here, because I don't want to lose my license.
I don't know what you are talking about. This is the craziest, the most insane thing.
Stop it! I'm going to make it easy for you. You were jealous. You had a fight. He fell. He hit his head. It was an accident. But his girl is a witness. so you had to shut her up. You don't have the guts to harm her, but you got the money to keep her mouth shut. Yes or no?
No!
Who is she? And don't give me that crap about your sister because you don't have a sister.
I'll tell you the truth.
Good. What's her name?
Catherine.
Catherine who?
She's my daughter.
I said I want the truth.
She's my sister. She's my daughter. My sister, my daughter.
I said I want the truth.
She's my sister and my daughter.
Forgive me if I'm wrong, but isn't there a lot of cutting on, I think I remember reading this in this section, a lot of cutting on movement in
yes.
that scene or that film in particular?
Yes.
Yeah, what does that do?
That scene in particular. And then there's the classic slap, which I love to talk about, when Jack Nicholson slaps Faye Dunaway, you think he slapped her, but he really hasn't. And the way I use frame grabs in the invisible cut is I show the actual cut. So I show the last frame of the preceding shot and the first frame of the following shot. So what you see is you see her head, his arm swing all the way around as if he's already slapped her in the last frame. And then the following frame of the next shot, you see that her head has swung around as if she's already been slapped. So you never see the slap, but the noise.
But your mind fills in the gaps.
Well,
yeah.
You blink because you hear the sound, and it's one of those great illusions that editors can create, knowing where you're looking and knowing what you're hearing.
Mm-hmm.
They can do all kinds of magic. So.
Yeah, it is incredible. There's so much, that is subliminal and. In this art, that's fascinating to me. In your personal interactions with Mr. Polanski, what is your sense of the man?
I just, you know, I actually feel badly because I love him. I think he's a wonderful man, and I think he's just gotten such a bad rap on so many levels, and he's had such a incredibly tragic life.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain things he'll say that, you know, just remind me of that. And even the themes of his movies reflect that tragedy. And when we came to work on, when Sam was working on Frantic or Tess, I can't remember, he picked us up at the airport and carried our luggage, you know?
Wow.
And practically killed us in the process because he's a crazy driver. He has this kind of, I wouldn't say it's like he's an adventurer. He's a little bit tempting fate all the time. He's kind of wild, you know. But he's an incredibly warm person. He's just a beautiful man. And, you know, people associate the subject matter of his films with the person.
Yeah.
And it's such a fallacy, you know. It's a shame, really.
Yeah, which absolutely he has. I've heard him in interviews. He's dismissed any kind of, you know, I work out things through the subject matter I choose. It just, we are doing the tribute on him because, first of all, he's one of the great directors, but also one of the most jaw-dropping lives of any director.
Yeah. Well, Sam, you know, Sam was around during some of those terrible times. I mean, he saw him right after Sharon Tate got murdered.
Yeah.
When he flew back to America from London, and he was hiding on the studio lot from the press, and he, you know, Sam embraced him and saw him that next day. And he knew them quite well. This was before I met Sam, but he spent quite a bit of time with Sharon and Roman. So, and they really were madly in love, and, you know, it was.
And for him to have maintained that level of childlike enthusiasm that you've talked about is amazing.
It is amazing. I think, you know, it's funny because in a way, obviously, his choices in subject matter and in material and just his general opportunities to make films is more limited now because of the fact that he can't leave France. Mm-hmm. I mean, even Tess, he couldn't go to England, so they had to bring cows over from England because he wanted the Jersey cows. So, but I just, you know, it's a shame because he would have so many more opportunities. But on the other hand, he is a big fish in a small pond there. He's a rock star. You go to a restaurant and there's photographs of him, you know, interacting with the owner. And also, you know, it's interesting, the European culture and his life, or especially the French culture, I should say, they have a different perspective on him. So, and he has a wonderful marriage and two children. And so, in a way, it's a nice life. I mean, I can see the upside to it too. You know.
Okay, that's Bobbi Osteen talking about her late husband Sam Osteen and his work with Polanski, and her two books are great. The Invisible Cut and Cut to the Chase, they're available now, and there are lots of anecdotes and stories and insights into Polanski and these films that we've been
mm-hmm.
talking about.
Yeah.
Okay, the last segment of the show, and then, Jerry, I want to get back to you before we close about...
Can I just say something about our next guest?
Yes.
And I really do want to say this because I mean this. One, and I had said this in the interview on Film Snobbery to an extent, but Keith Ulick is one of my favorite byproducts of this show. I had no idea who he was before we did this, and we discovered him during the Brian De Palma tribute show. But I will say this right now. Keith Ulick is the smartest, the funniest person that we've had on the show, and he is by far the ultimate movie geek, and he has the greatest cinematic knowledge I've ever encountered in my 39 years that I've been alive. He is, by all means, what it means to be a movie geek, what it means to be a cinephile, what it means to love film. And I hope that in my experiences from here on out that I can grasp and encounter as much cinematic love as he has.
Yeah, he's a real, very knowledgeable, and I mean, it's apparent from this upcoming conversation, and he brings up such interesting insights into Polanski, and it makes you rethink a lot of things in Polanski's work, and that's the most valuable thing you can give as a critic,
mm-hmm.
and he's one of the best, and this conversation is a critical discussion of Polanski's resume of films, and Keith is... As Jerry made clear, he's a great friend to the show and one of the brightest and most engaging film critics out there. And you can read his film criticism in Time Out New York and The House Next Door online.
Mm-hmm.
So here is Keith. I've been seeing previous interviews with Polanski, and inevitably it's always brought up, you know, his kind of the tragedies that have occurred in his life.
Yeah,
and how they have possibly shaped him as a filmmaker, the themes mm-hmm. that he deals with. He puts no stock in that whatsoever. I'm wondering, do you think that that plays any kind of role in his film work?
Well, as a critic, one who like interprets, you know, people's work. I mean, I do often draw on what I know of people's lives. I guess I would say personally that I'm trying to move somewhat away from that. I mean, I don't think you can help it. I mean, you know, just speaking as one who considers himself an artist also, you know,
mm-hmm.
rare that people say criticism is an art, I guess, but I think it is. You know, I believe that my work says something about me that maybe I'm not even aware of or necessarily have the words to express. I mean, honestly, I think maybe that's what critics are for, is to kind of, you know, give their own interpretation of it and to interpret the person who's creating, who we think is the creative force behind it as well. And, you know, it's easy for that to slip over into gossip and, you know, untoward kinds of commentary. At the same time, I think that it can be very, you know, insightful and valid to deal with a person's life. And I mean, I feel like, you know, in ways that I would say, like, body horror is Cronenberg's great theme, or, you know, or childhood, or childhood, like middle-class childhood, I might even say, like Spielberg's great theme or something like that. You know, I think the Holocaust and what Polanski went through really does infect all of his movies. And I do think it's kind of a weird infection kind of thing, where you feel a kind of sickness in them. And I don't mean that as a negative criticism per se. It's just you feel something, so you can sort of sense a poison running through without necessarily yourself being poisoned. And
mm-hmm.
it's interesting in that way, you know. And I mean, I think that's kind of what I gravitate towards in his movies. Is I think their perversity springs from a very knowledgeable place.
In that he has experienced in his own life the perverse and disgusting aspects of others.
Yes, and meted it out himself, if I might go there. You know, I think that's valid to say. I think that's what's wonderful about his movies too, is that he acknowledges his complicity as a human being in all this. You know, he's not one who I've ever gotten the sense stands above. I mean, I think you just look at, like, The Tenant, for example, to show that he put himself front and center in that. And I think he was really dealing with some of the perversity that had been done to him and that he had done and maybe perhaps since he would do. So I throw that out there for whatever it's worth. I feel that in his movies, and that's, you know, what attracts me, and you know, I guess in a strange way repulses. But you know, I mean, I think there are movies and there are artists who you are repulsed by, and yet you're attracted to, and you have to try, and you feel that contradiction, and that's I think it's a beautiful thing when you can feel the contradictory impulses of a person coming through in their work.
Yeah. When did your awareness of Polanski begin? What film?
Trying to remember specifically what film. I mean, I think I had been aware of, like, Rosemary's Baby. The one that was transformative was Repulsion. When I saw that, it was, I think, around the same time that I also saw Todd Haynes' Safe, and those two movies kind of made my kind of solidified and crystallized my obsession with kind of like female melodramas and female psychology in movies and how it's dealt with and such. The whole, I think Repulsion, I had said at one point, was like this one of the scariest movies that ever made. Maybe it was the scariest movie. I'll now just say it is one of the, I think it is just absolutely horrifying that it portrays mental breakdown in a way that is so true to the experience while being true to the two-dimensionality of movies, you know, at the same time. And yet it feels like it's reaching out at you and, like, grabbing you and infecting your soul in some way. And I love that. So.
Do you see a particular understanding or a particular angle that he takes with his female characters that is unique?
Well, certainly. I mean, I'm just, and I would even say in how he approaches just femininity in general. I mean, you know, the whole big climax of The Tenant is that he himself dresses up in drag, you know, and jumps off the apartment building, you know, and all. And it's like, and that's like a kind of weird crystallization of things. You know, there's this line between genders or other things there's a line basically, I think, that he always crosses in his movies. You know, you can see in Chinatown, My Sister, My Daughter, to the point where it's like, you know, Evelyn Mulray is so fucked up. You know, she doesn't know what is true. Even it's like it's all true and it's all not true. It's like, again, the contradictions existing simultaneously in something. And, you know, in Repulsion, it's the line of madness. and maybe madness is the proper place to be for that particular character. And then, you know, there's the object of obsession in Bitter Moon, who is basically just at first a complete object of desire, and then that desire just kind of breaks down and breaks down and breaks down until it becomes just like kind of a standard, you know, poisonous relationship in a way. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, the object of desire becomes something all too mortal. And then even in something like Pulpy, which I love the movie, is The Ninth Gate, where again, Emmanuel Seigneur, his wife, who's the object of desire in Bitter Moon, and here she's kind of like this devilish angel of sorts, who's kind of dressed as in this in just ratty clothes and rides a motorcycle and such, and yet, you know, at the end she kind of helps the hero Johnny Depp to transcend himself, albeit to devilish purposes, you know, and that too, you know, it's like, yeah. the way he looks at women, I think, is extremely complicated, you know, not just at women, of course, at men too, and I think he uses men in some ways as these kind of passive voyeurs, especially if we look at like The Pianist or something like that, where Brody just kind of walks through the movie looking at things. And then, of course, there's like Death of the Maiden, which is, you know, not his written work, but, you know, I mean, he directs it certainly like a Polanski film where, you know, I think there's a whole bunch of confusion of genders in terms of, you know, Sigourney Weaver with that kind of masculine haircut and saying that she's going to do to Ben Kingsley what he supposedly did to her many years ago, and kind of reversing the rape roles, as you would. It speaks to an understanding of the darkness of people's souls, or maybe not necessarily even the darkness, but certainly the capability of things. A person's capability for doing, for transgressing and transgression. I think that's probably off the point of women, but, you know.
I think that's
the tangled knot that he weaves.
Yeah. And he's working in, of course, he's known for his thrillers. Some sophisticated, some pulpy, like you said, with mm-hmm. The Ninth Gate. But people tend to dismiss the thriller genre, mm-hmm. I think, in terms of reverence. What is his unique stamp on that genre, do you think? Something like Rosemary's Baby, I think. Rosemary's Baby was assembled as a William Castle co-production. William Castle wanted to direct it. You could see it taking that direction, the William Castle kind of direction.
Sure.
Polanski brings something completely different to it. How would you define that?
I think he grounds his thrillers in very specific milieus and very well-rounded and defined milieus. For example, in Rosemary's Baby, it's an upper-class Manhattan milieu that I think is very believable. And in The Ninth Gate, I think it's the world of book aficionados, to the point that I feel like the movie itself and its photograph of Darius Kanji kind of takes on the feel and texture and look of a musty old book in a strange way. You know, it's kind of like his films, it's not just the thrillers. It's like he brings to his movies a certain kind of texture. You can look at it and you can see it and you can feel it. You can almost feel it. You can reach out and feel it in a certain way. You know, they're tactile in a way that I think I think really only a great movie maker is capable of doing. You know, kind of like I feel the cigar smoke emanating off of a Sam Fuller movie or I don't know how I would describe Spielberg, but there's a tactility to Spielberg as well that I don't even know if I necessarily have words for. Or like Bergman's view of the world, you know, is very tactile and you feel it.
Right.
It's like that. It's only unique to Polanski in the sense of what he brings to it. And I know one of my colleagues, Ed Gonzalez, like was talking about, I think, Oliver Twist, which I actually haven't watched yet. But he was talking about how Polanski shoots along parallel lines, or how shots are created with a certain kind of odd-angled linearity in a way. And I'm not really using his term specifically, but he had a way of describing Polanski's way of cutting and of framing a shot and of putting those shots together that, you know, just was the hallmark of someone who had great talent for what he was doing. The opening of The Ninth Gate, where the first thing you hear is just these scribbles on a page over darkness as the credits are starting. And then, you know, so already it's like something is being etched into the film almost. It's like the film is paper. It's like he's implying, you know, the film is paper and you must consider it as that. And then it goes to, you know, the old gentleman in his study writing his suicide note, essentially. And then the way Polanski films the suicide is just so matter of fact and like almost comical too, in the way of, you know, just focusing on the feet as they like just shake, you know, after the guy's neck has been broken. You know, the body's just reacting to the violence of the shake, and then just like, and then it just, you know, and it falls and it just falls down, and then it's like there's this great beautiful like digitally assisted pan up, you know, past the body into the blank part of the shelf where the book that the character is going to be searching for is, you know, is missing. And it's just, he's given you this piece of information, this suicide that you have no context for even. And then he emphasizes this, that this film is itself kind of a musty text and a history in a way. And he's going to take you through it. But it's not the kind of thing where I feel like he's over-artying up the pulp or anything. I think he's very attuned to the pulp, and I think he respects pulpy situations in ways that a lot of other directors or artists do not. And I'm a huge fan of directors who take pulpy things seriously.
In Chinatown, this is classic Los Angeles film noir.
Yes.
But it can't help but be completely unique within that genre because it comes from Polanski.
Indeed, and it's a very interesting pairing too with a film that came out the year before, The Long Goodbye by Robert Altman.
Yes.
You know, in terms of how they both they take the post-war film noir genre, you know, which it grows in the as sort of a an acidic in the acidic aftermath of World War II, post World War II, and it recontextualizes it for the 70s, you know, or for that particular era, you know, I guess some people might call it postmodern. I don't know. There's something very modern about both those films in the way, even, you know, in the way they recontextualize this this genre that you know, I think Paul Schrader had wrote an essay on film noir that was very influential and you know, explained what it was. And you know, here were these new Turks at the time thinking it. Although I think what's interesting, of course, is that, you know, I don't think either Polanski and Altman are unique in the sense in that I don't think they belong to any specific generation. In America, let's say. I mean, Polanski came from a history of, like, Polish filmmakers. I think Altman was sort of, like, at the head of his class in the way that Romero was sort of at the head of the New Wave class, in the sense that he was a little bit older than a lot of the young Turks coming up. And, you know, and Polanski, I think, had a similar kind of outsider status that made him unique among the 70s filmmakers, you know, who were often thought of in a group together, like Spielberg and Coppola and all them. Within certain generations, you have the generational filmmakers, and then you have the anomalous ones, maybe the ones who are just a little outside it for one reason or another. You know,
yes.
And I feel like Polanski has that, and that makes his films feel a little bit out of time in a way,
yes.
And at their best, then, of course, timeless.
At the base level, I think it's interesting. It's always interesting when a foreign director attempts a typical American genre. I see it with Ang Lee, with a lot of his work. And that's a fascinating dynamic to see our culture through an outsider's eyes. Let me run through a couple of these films and get your take on them. Macbeth, Polanski does Shakespeare, obviously one of the darkest plays in Shakespeare's
career. Yes, and one of the darkest films of Polanski's career. I mean, I remember seeing that for the first time, and I think it's like, you know, the witch's speech, fair is foul, foul is fair, it's just like kind of, they just kind of whisper it, and they're just like spitting on everything, and they're like just the ultimate hags. It's like, it's not theatrical at all. It's just, it's grounded in this, you know, in this disgusting landscape. That of course, you know, everybody considers that film his, I think it was his first post-Manson film. And of course it becomes so tempting to like say, well, okay, Sharon Tate was, you know, brutally butchered, and here, you know, is his response to that in a way, or here's how he's channeling that. You know, it's very tempting to do that. And I think you could make a good case for it. Of course, you know, the trick of it might be is that maybe we're giving too much credence to the life of sex art thing, because I mean, certainly the darkness was always there, and it's not surprising that he would take Macbeth in this bizarre direction, albeit, you know, it is so gory and, you know, just off-putting.
Dirty,
Going
back to that concept of the life affecting the artist and his work, I understand why Polanski dismisses that notion, because unlike you as a critic, it's your job to read these things into it, and me as a movie lover, it's almost a game to play when you're examining these movies for me. But I think it would be damaging to the artist to step over that kind of mysterious boundary, to really kind of delve deep and find out where that's coming from. Don't you think so?
Yeah, I mean, that actually reminds me of the story about David Lynch, when he went to an analyst once and said, you know, if I tell you all these, if I delve into my feelings, do you think that it's possible I might lose, you know, some of my connection to my ideas and stuff? And the analyst said it was possible, and he basically said, then it's not worth it to me, and he left. You know, it's kind of like, the way artists deal with their baggage is through their art. You know, I mean, that's the psychoanalysis, in a sense. I mean, my friend, who's a filmmaker, Ira Sachs, talks about, you know, his approach to film as being psychoanalytic, in the sense of he's trying to understand the characters and the milieu that he's, you know, trying to put down, and also probably reveal some aspect of himself that maybe he's not even necessarily conscious of.
Yeah.
You know, and so I mean, I would, you know, I'm one who says, first of all, that, you know, artists do not owe their audience anything. I feel like there's too much of an imprisonment to pleasing a crowd, as opposed to, you know, delving into oneself through one's art. And I think that's more what I think an artist owes is a complete explication of oneself through their work, and to be open to that, to allow whatever you are conducting from whatever, you know, other place, you know, where ideas come from, you know, what Lynch talks about it is, I think, like catching the big fish, you know, like from this like river of thought, you know, where you just grab the ideas, you know, out of, and they just, and you channel them into whatever your art is. I mean, that's what I think artists need to be, is open to being the conduit for, you know, wherever these vague ideas come from, and then you channel that into something concrete. And I think Polanski is very open to that. And the fact, that he says, you know, I don't want to, I dismiss the notion of my work being interpreted through my life, is either defense mechanism, willful ignorance, or sheer and utter bullshit. But how many great artists have, you know, spouted sheer and utter bullshit in their interviews and then given the beautiful things, you know?
Yeah. I think it's completely valid for the artist. I recall Quentin Tarantino was on Charlie Rose months ago, and he said, I don't consider necessarily an overall theme in my work or my connection personally to the subjects and the characters that I write. I like that to come years afterwards upon reflection. I think if you define that thing as an artist, you're going to do one of two things. You're going to be very conscious of those things at work, and you're going to approach your work along those lines consciously. Or you're going to work against it. And I think either way, that's going to end up being dishonest work.
Right, right. Yeah. I would agree with that. I mean, but you know what? It's easier to be dishonest. Correctly.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Yeah. It's and so I understand why people do that, because it takes a lot of willpower to be open to all the different perspectives that you can channel into your work and give your comment on. It's easier to just sort of stick to hoary old formulas that you can just sort of copy from a template, or you just shut yourself off and you go through the motions. I mean, you can tell when an artist is doing that too. I understand it because I include myself in having done it because again, it's easier.
Woody Allen, when he was interviewed, he said, look, I don't feel I've had any influence on film culture for this reason. I look and I don't see anyone that emulates me. You can look at somebody like P.T. Anderson. You can see the Altman, Scorsese connection, that influence. Do you see filmmakers out there with a strong Polanski influence?
No, really, because Polanski is so inimitably himself. And I'm not necessarily saying that when you're inimitably yourself that you're necessarily a great artist per se, but I don't think that just automatically makes you great. But I do think it's one aspect of a great artist they cannot be imitated, even though there might be people who try. Now, the thing is, I don't really see many people trying with Polanski. Certainly, I see them trying with Altman. Certainly, they try with Tarantino. Certainly, Spielberg. You know, there are filmmakers who are uniquely themselves but easily imitated. What's kind of nice about Polanski is that Polanski is uniquely himself but can't be imitated because his neuroses are so specific to him.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody could imitate Cronenberg really very well either, because that is, you know, that kind of body horror and exploration of sexuality and humanity is so specific to him. It's like there are some people who nobody even tries. Maybe because, you know, it's so deep-rooted in psychology that there's nothing really on the surface to imitate. Because I think if you think of Polanski's surfaces, I don't think they're particularly flashy. I think they stem from a kind of a psychological interior that cannot be imitated because it's so amorphous. You know, I don't think that Rosemary's Baby looks like The Ninth Gate, looks like Death and the Maiden. You know, I would say of Tarantino's movies, for example, that they all have specific stylistic quirks from movie to movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think with Polanski, I can't think of like a signature, you know, Polanski shot per se. You know, it's not like there aren't beautiful shots or anything, but it's kind of like what he's doing is coming from somewhere really, really deep inside, frighteningly so in a lot of cases. And it's just like if it wasn't him doing it, the movies wouldn't, you know, even if they wouldn't look the same. you know, but none of them look the same as is. They all have their own unique visual sense and style and such. And so when you talk about a Polanski film, you know, you're talking about a very varied body of work in terms of its surfaces, for sure. You know, Rosemary's Baby, I'd say, is almost banal in a lot of its visualizations. The Ninth Gate, I'd say, is very lush and as I say, mimics a book, you know, in a lot of ways. And then you get to Death and the Maiden, which makes heavy use of rear projection, rear projected backgrounds in a way that enhance the psychological state. You know, Bitter Moon starts in like this very lush and sensuous register, and then just becomes increasingly horrible and deadening. It's like, you know, it's like so much sex eventually leads to depletion, and the movie just depletes as it goes along. It just depletes and depletes, and then there's like the graininess of Macbeth. Just like, it's like there's dirt and grime everywhere. So I mean, you know, as I'm talking about this, no one Polanski film is exactly the same as any other that I can think of.
I want to ask you about obviously one of his most acclaimed films of recent years before I let you go, and that's The Pianist. In one interview I saw of his, he said, look, I don't feel that I've made my masterpiece yet, even though the one I'm about to embark on might be that for me. And that was The Pianist he was speaking of.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously he got the Best Director Oscar for it, and it was a very successful film, both for him personally and in terms of box office. What was your take on that, and how that fits into his work?
I am not really a fan of the movie. Mm-hmm. And my reasoning for that is that is probably would bring us back to the biographical aspects. All of Polanski's movies, I felt, for me, were dealing with the Holocaust before this in some way, and the horrors that he went through, and not just the Holocaust, but I think that was a very particular defining moment. And each film of his, whether it was pulpy, whether it was arty, whatever you want to call it, all the ones that I saw seemed to deal with the psychological horrors that could be inflicted on a person and the physical horrors that could be inflicted on a person, that I think the Holocaust, and also the sense of something out there, you know, threatening you, that you don't know when it's going to get you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when is, you know, the Nazi threat is all pervasive, especially towards a Polish Jew, you know, and yet it's like, how do I get out of this? And I just feel that in dealing with it indirectly, he achieved something more profoundly about it than when he was dealing with it directly. So when he directly dealt with the Holocaust, something was lost in a weird way. And, you know, and that was strange to me, you know, when I experienced that. I was like, wow, this just really isn't working for me very much. And it just seemed that, again, he had dealt with everything so implicitly and through, you know, implication, that he kind of didn't need to make his Holocaust movie because he already had, you know, it was buried under the surface of all his other films. And so now in bringing it to the surface, I feel like The Pianist then just becomes all surface. Brody's performance is essentially, he's a blank slate. I don't think there's anything in that character. I think he is a sock puppet, straw man, you know, whatever you want to call him. I don't think he has a soul, essentially. And I mean, that's kind of interest, you know, in certain ways. But, you know, I don't think the movie in any way works as a standard biopic. It's purely a point. It take The Pianist from this point to this point, to kind of thing, you know. And it's like, you know, I can't read anything into that character, because I don't think he has a place in the landscape. He's an anonymous figure. I suppose that's of interest in a certain way, but I feel like the movie itself has an anonymity to it that just doesn't feel like Polanski to me.
Okay, that's Keith Ulick talking about the career of Roman Polanski, in his filmography. So we ended that on a controversial note.
How is it controversial? Because he doesn't like the pianist? Let me say this. His opinions about the pianist, and I mean, yeah, I do think that every film, you watch Repulsion, you watch The Tenet, yeah, it's all about the Holocaust. Every film is about the Holocaust. Let me say this. When your mom is killed by a bunch of Nazi goons, it's going to influence the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is the fascinating basis of where that conversation began.
Yeah.
How we see the influences of the events in his life through
now,
his work.
Yeah.
I think that is very valuable in is it stronger to deal with it implicitly or explicitly?
Yeah.
Like he did in The Pianist. I think that's a very valid argument to make.
I mean, I agree with him. Like all the previous films, even Death and the Maiden, for that matter.
Sure.
It deals with the Holocaust. It's and while I'm saying that The Pianist is, I think in some ways is better than Schindler's List, I'm not discounting Schindler's List. Schindler's List is very honest, the most honest film that until Munich that Spielberg makes about Judaism. But it's really at the end of Schindler's List where those survivors have escaped the camps, the war has ended. And I think I don't know whether it's a Russian officer. He says, well, you know, they don't like you down there. They don't like you up there. They don't like you up the west of there. I mean, it's as though Spielberg understands everything there is to know about Judaism and anti-Semitism, and it's there, and it's a very powerful moment. It's something, if you're like me, raised with that kind of belief, Schindler's List is the greatest movie ever made. But then a couple of years later, The Pianist comes out, and The Pianist is brutal, just brutal. I don't care who you are. It is a brutal film.
Well, but I think it works on the strengths of many of his films, and this is another thing that we talked about, and this is what's so haunting about his work. The overriding sense, and you can't define it, you can't articulate it, but there's this tactile sense that Keith talked about, that something bad is going to happen.
Yeah.
And if you consider Polanski's life, And how could you be rooted in being content or at ease? There's always something bad around the corner, you know, through the history of the events of his life.
Yeah.
That's why he works particularly well for thrillers. I mean,
that's
a powerful well to draw upon.
Yeah, it is. And I've read this book, this Robert Harris book, The Ghost, because I'm a big Robert Harris fan. I've read every book.
Right.
And I love... And so originally it was going to be Pompeii that Polanski was going to do, but then he decided to do The Ghost, which is a thinly veiled Tony Blair caricature in some ways, and it's a great thriller. It's just a great read, and I look forward to seeing it one day.
And he's also talked about adapting that play that was a big hit with Daniels and Gandolfini and
I
forget what the name of that is, but that's perfect for
him. No, I remember
that. Because that's about behavioral violence that we inflict upon each other.
It is. You're absolutely right.
We're going to close with a question, Jerry, and this is probably the most difficult question of all when it comes to Polanski. And
God, you have to do that. I know that on Saturday nights you think, what can I do to do this to Jerry? But okay,
stump the Jerry. If we look 50 years from now, you know, when we're gone possibly, what will Polanski's legacy be? How will he be remembered?
I think let's just take away all the tabloid aspects of the last week and the last couple of decades. I think he'll be remembered as a true chronicler of the human condition, and that goes for all of his films. I think never before, and also never after, has there been a gentleman who has been able to capture certain periods of time so perfectly. And regardless of what my favorite critic Keith says, he's captured the Holocaust, but he's also captured early Los Angeles. And if it wasn't for him, the horror genre would be sadly lacking. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't for Rosemary's Baby, and I think I said this in the William Frecker interview, we would not have a horror genre if it was not for Rosemary's Baby. I firmly believe that.
Which is a blessing and a curse, because when you do it so well, you have to deal with decades of pale imitations.
Well, there are a lot of pale imitations there. But,
which is what has dragged out the genre since.
Yeah, but it's not only that. It's what we talked about with Brett Ratner. I think I was really taken by Ratner's appreciation for The Tenant.
Yeah,
I really was. I mean, it really moved me. I had only seen this movie 4 or 5 years ago because I think it finally came out on DVD. The same with The Fearless Vampire Killers. But when listening to Ratner talk about Polanski, I was like, wow, that was an eye-opening experience.
Yeah, it's a big movie. It's a big movie for him, and it's a very curious movie, and it's not. It's like Keith said, you can't easily reconcile some of these movies in your mind. It's
mm-hmm.
There's something so fascinating about a movie like The Tenant or Bitter Moon.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know quite why you like it. You don't know if you do like it. You just have to examine it more and more to get a firm grasp. And
right.
There's so much at work. With any artist, there's so much at work that is beyond the surface of what's on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel it in a Polanski film.
You do. You really do.
And we're happy that we were able to bring you guys this show. And we appreciate everyone listening in, either live or on replay and taking part. Check us out on our website, moviegeeksunited.net. Send us an email, moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. Join us on Facebook, on MySpace. Does anybody use MySpace anymore?
I still go on MySpace. I know what you mean. It's a ghost town.
Yeah. Twitter, we're on, send us a tweet. I mean, God bless, send us a tweet.
Yeah, no, it's great. I would like to say about The Ninth Gate, though.
Yes.
There is something that needs to be said. It's one of the most beautiful soundtracks I own.
Worsted Kalar, yeah, I'm not sure how to pronounce his first name, but yes, you're right. The same guy that did Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Yeah, and they're both beautiful soundtracks. But The Ninth Gate, just from the opening chords to the last chord, it's incredible.
I love
that soundtrack.
Of course, one of the great soundtracks with Rosemary's Baby. I mean, that
mm-hmm.
opening theme that we opened the show with.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a lullaby, but it's just like the movie. It's at once so beautiful and so eerie at the same time. I mean, it's perfect combination of that. And who could forget Jerry Goldsmith's Chinatown.
It's just incredible. But I would like to close with something, though. And
yeah.
If you wanted to add something to this, I went to go see the Two Jakes on opening day with my
mm-hmm.
best friend Mitch Garrett. And this was a long time ago, obviously. It's almost 20 years ago. And I said, I love this film, but my God, imagine if Roman had directed this.
Yeah. I'm sure everyone involved wanted to imagine that.
Yeah, I mean, but I don't hate the film, but just imagine if Roman Polanski had directed that.
Yeah, and if it became the trilogy that it set out to be.
Mm-hmm.
You and I talked about this. The first one was Chinatown was water. The Two Jakes was
oil. I think. Oil,
yeah.
And the third one was air.
Yeah, yeah. A movie about air.
I know. We could go.
That's exciting.
We could go several directions with that.
Exactly. All right, guys. Speaking of music scores, we're going to close out with a theme from Chinatown. We appreciate everyone's involvement. Jerry, thank you, my friend.
No, thank you. This was a lot of fun. This was a great show.
And we'll see you guys next time. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.